Our Enemy, the State, by Albert J. Nock. Part 6. Such has been the course of our experience from the beginning, and such are the terms in which its stark uniformity has led us to think of the state. This uniformity also goes far to account for the development of a peculiar moral innovation with regard to the state, exactly parallel to that which prevailed with regard to the church in the Middle Ages. The church controlled the distribution of certain privileges and immunities, and if one approached it properly, one might get the benefit of them. It stood as something to be run to in any kind of emergency, temporal or spiritual, for the satisfaction of ambition and cupidity, as well as for the more tenuous assurances it held out against various forms of fear, doubt, and sorrow. As long as this was so, the anomalies were more or less contentedly acquiesced in, and thus a chronic moral innovation, too negative to be called broadly cynical, was developed towards the vast overbuilding of its material structure. A like innovation pervades our society with respect to the state and for like reasons. It affects especially those who take the state's pretensions at face value and regard it as a social institution whose policies of continuous intervention are wholesome and necessary. And it also affects the great majority who have no clear idea of the state, but merely accept it as something that exists, and never think about it except when some intervention bears unfavourably upon their interests. There is little need to dwell upon the amount of aid thus given to the state's progress in self-aggrandizement, or to show in detail or by illustration the courses by which this spiritlessness promotes the state's steady policy of intervention, exaction, and overbuilding. Every intervention by the state enables another, and this in turn another, and so on indefinitely, and the state stands ever ready and eager to make them, often on its own motion, often again wangling plausibility for them through the specious suggestion of interested persons. Sometimes the matter at issue is in its nature simple, socially necessary, and devoid of any character that would bring it into the purview of politics. For convenience, however, complications are erected on it. Then presently someone sees that these complications are exploitable and proceeds to exploit them. Then another and another, until the rivalries and collisions of interest thus generate issue in a more or less general disorder. When this takes place, the logical thing, obviously, is to recede and let the disorder be settled in the slower and more troublesome way through the operation of natural laws. But in such circumstances, recession is never for a moment thought of. The suggestion would be put down as sheer lunacy. Instead, the interests unfavourably affected, little aware, perhaps, how much worse the cure is than the disease, or at any rate little caring, immediately call on the state to cut in arbitrarily between cause and effect, and clear up the disorder out of hand. The state then intervenes by imposing another set of complications upon the first. These in turn are found exploitable. Another demand arises, another set of complications, still more intricate, is erected upon the first two. And the same sequence is gone through again and again, until the recurrent disorder becomes acute enough to open the way for a sharking political adventurer to come forward and, always alleging necessity, the tyrant's plea, to organize a coup d'etat. But more often the basic matter at issue represents an original intervention of the state, an original allotment of the political means. Each of these allotments, as we have seen, is a charter of highwaymanry, a license to appropriate the labor products of others without compensation. Therefore, it is in the nature of things that when such a license is issued, the state must follow it up with an indefinite series of interventions to systematize and regulate its use. The state's endless progressive encroachments that are recorded in the history of the tariff, their impudent and disgusting particularity, and the prodigious amount of apparatus necessary to give them effect, furnish a conspicuous case in point. Another is furnished by the history of our railway regulation. It is nowadays of the fashion, even among those who ought to know better, to hold rugged individualism and laissez-faire responsible for the riot of stock-watering, rebates, rate-cutting, fraudulent bankruptcies and the like, which prevailed in our railway practice after the Civil War. But they had no more to do with it than they have with the precession of the equinoxes. The fact is that our railways, with few exceptions, did not grow up in response to any actual economic demand. They were speculative enterprises enabled by state intervention, by allotment of the political means in the form of land grants and subsidies. And of all the evils alleged against our railway practice, there is not one but what is directly traceable to this primary intervention. So it is with shipping. There was no valid economic demand for adventure in the carrying trade. In fact, every sound economic consideration was dead against it. It was entered upon through state intervention, instigated by shipbuilders and their allied interests, and the mess engendered by their manipulation of the political means is now the ground of demand for further and further coercive intervention. So it is with what, by an unconscionable stretch of language, goes by the name of farming. There are very few troubles so far heard of as normally besetting this form of enterprise, but what are directly traceable to the state's primary intervention in establishing a system of land tenure, which gives a monopoly right over rental values as well as over use values. As long as that system is in force, one coercive intervention after another is bound to take place in support of it. 2. Thus we see how ignorance and delusion concerning the nature of the state combine with extreme moral debility and myopic self-interest, what Ernest Renan so well calls la bassesse de l'homme intérêt, to enable the steadily accelerated conversion of social power into state power that has gone on from the beginning of our political independence. It is a curious anomaly. State power has an unbroken record of inability to do anything efficiently, economically, disinterestedly, or honestly. Yet when the slightest dissatisfaction arises over any exercise of social power, the aid of the agent least qualified to give aid is immediately called for. Does social power mismanage banking practice in this or that special instance? Then let the state, which never has shown itself able to keep its own finances from sinking promptly into the slough of misfeasance, wastefulness and corruption, intervene to supervise or regulate the whole body of banking practice, or even take it over entire. Does social power in this or that case bungle the business of railway management? Then let the state, which has bungled every business it has ever undertaken, intervene and put its hand to the business of regulating railway operation. Does social power now and then send out an unseaworthy ship to disaster, then let the state, which inspected and passed the Morro Castle, be given a freer swing at controlling the routine of the shipping trade. Does social power here and there exercise a grinding monopoly over the generation and distribution of electric current, then let the state, which allots and maintains monopoly, come in and intervene with a general scheme of price fixing which works more unforeseen hardships than it heals, or else let it go into direct competition, or, as the collectivists urge, let it take over the monopoly bodily. Ever since society has existed, says Herbert Spencer, disappointment has been preaching. Put not your trust in legislation. And yet the trust in legislation seems hardly diminished. But it may be asked where we are to go for relief from misuses of social power, if not to the state. What other recourse have we? Admitting that under our existing mode of political organization we have none, it must still be pointed out that this question rests on the old inveterate misapprehension of the state's nature, presuming that the state is a social institution, whereas it is an antisocial institution. That is to say, the question rests on an absurdity. It is certainly true that the business of government in maintaining freedom and security, and to secure these rights is to make a recourse to justice costless, easy, and informal. But the state, on the contrary, is primarily concerned with injustice, and its primary function is to maintain a regime of injustice. Hence, as we see daily, its disposition is to put justice as far out of reach, and to make the effort after justice as costly and difficult as it can. One may put in a word that, while government is by its nature concerned with the administration of justice, the state is by its nature concerned with the administration of law, law which the state itself manufactures for the service of its own primary ends. Therefore, an appeal to the state based on the ground of justice is futile in any circumstances. For whatever action the state might take in response to it would be conditioned by the state's own paramount interest, and would hence be bound to result, as we see such action invariably resulting, in as great injustice as that which it pretends to be correct, or, as a rule, greater. The question thus presumes, in short, that the state may on occasion be persuaded to act out of character, and this is levity. But passing on from this special view of the question, and regarding it in a more general way, we see that what it actually amounts to is a plea for arbitrary interference with the order of nature, an arbitrary cutting in to avert the penalty which nature lays on any and every form of error, whether wilful or ignorant, voluntary or involuntary, and no attempt at this has ever yet failed to cost more than it came to. Any contravention of natural law, any tampering with the natural order of things, must have its consequences, and the only recourse for escaping them is such as entails worse consequences. Nature recks nothing of intentions good or bad. The one thing she will not tolerate is disorder, and she is very particular about getting her full pay for any attempt to create disorder. She gets it sometimes by very indirect methods, often by very roundabout and unforeseen ways, but she always gets it. "Things and actions are what they are, and the consequences of them will be what they will be. Why, then, should we desire to be deceived?" It would seem that our civilization is greatly given to this infantile addiction, greatly given to persuading itself that it can find some means which nature will tolerate, whereby we may eat our cake and have it. And it strongly resents the stubborn fact that there is no such means. It will be clear to anyone who takes the trouble to think the matter through that under a regime of natural order, that is to say, under government, which makes no positive interventions whatever on the individual, but only negative interventions on behalf of simple justice, not law, but justice, misuses of social power would be effectively corrected, whereas we know by interminable experience that the state's positive interventions do not correct them. Under a regime of actual individualism, actual free competition, actual laissez-faire, a regime which, as we have seen, cannot possibly coexist with the state, a serious or continuous misuse of social power would be virtually impracticable. I shall not take up space with amplifying these statements because, in the first place, this has already been done by Spencer in his essays entitled The Man Versus the State, and in the second place, because I wish above all things to avoid the appearance of suggesting that a regime such as these statements contemplate is practicable, or that I am ever so covertly encouraging anyone to dwell on the thought of such a regime. Perhaps some eons hence, if the planet remains so long habitable, the benefits accruing to conquest and confiscation may be adjudged over costly. The state may in consequence be superseded by government, the political means suppressed, and the fetishes which give nationalism and patriotism their present execrable character may be broken down. But the remoteness and uncertainty of this prospect makes any thought of it fatuous and any concern with it futile. Some rough measure of its remoteness may perhaps be gained by estimating the growing strength of the forces at work against it. ignorance and error, which the state's prestige steadily deepens, are against it. La bassesse de l'homme interesse, steadily pushing its purposes to greater lengths of turpitude, is against it. Moral enervation, steadily proceeding to the point of complete insensitiveness, is against it. What combination of influences more powerful than this can one imagine, and what can one imagine possible to be done in the face of such a combination? To the sum of these, which may be called spiritual influences, may be added the overweening physical strength of the state, which is ready to be called into action at once against any affront to the state's prestige. Few realize how enormously and how rapidly in recent years the state has everywhere built up its apparatus of armies and police forces. The state has thoroughly learned the lesson laid down by Septimus Severus on his deathbed. "Stick together," he said to his successors. "Pay the soldiers and don't worry about anything else." It is now known to every intelligent person that there can be no such thing as a revolution as long as this advice is followed. In fact, there has been no revolution in the modern world since 1848. Every so-called revolution has been merely a coup d'etat. All talk of the possibility of a revolution in America is in part perhaps ignorant, but mostly dishonest. It is merely the interested clamours and sophistry of persons who have some sort of axe to grind. Even Lenin acknowledged that a revolution is impossible anywhere until the military and police forces become disaffected, and the last place to look for that, probably, is here. We have all seen demonstrations of a disarmed populace, and local riots carried on with primitive weapons, and we have also seen how they ended, as in Homestead, Chicago, and the mining districts of West Virginia, for example. Coxey's army marched on Washington, and it kept off the grass. Taking the sum of the state's physical strength with the force of powerful spiritual influences behind it, one asks again, what can be done against the state's progress in self-aggrandizement? Simply nothing. So far from encouraging any hopeful contemplation of the unattainable, the student of civilized man will offer no conclusion but that nothing can be done. He can regard the course of civilization only as he would regard the course of a man in a narrowboat on the lower reaches of the Niagara, as an instance of nature's unconquerable intolerance of disorder, and in the end, an example of the penalty which she puts upon any attempt at interference with order. Our civilization may at the outset have taken its chances with the current of statism, either ignorantly or deliberately. It makes no difference. Nature cares for nothing whatever about motive or intention. She cares only for order, and looks to see that her repugnance to disorder shall be vindicated, and that her concern with the regular orderly sequences of things and actions shall be upheld in the outcome. Emerson, in one of his greatest moments of inspiration, personified cause and effect as the chancellors of God, and invariable experience testifies that the attempt to nullify or divert or in any wise break upon their sequences must have its own reward. Such, says Professor Ortega Agassiz, was the lamentable fate of ancient civilization. A dozen empires have already finished the course that ours began 3 centuries ago. The lion and the lizard keep the vestiges that attest their passage upon earth, vestiges of cities which in their day were as proud and as powerful as ours. Tadmor, Persepolis, Luxor, Baalbek, some of them indeed forgotten for thousands of years and brought into memory again only by the excavator, like those of the Mayas and those buried in the sands of the Gobi. The sites which now bear Narbonne and Marseille have borne the habitat of 4 successive civilizations, each of them, as St. James says, even as a vapour which appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. The course of all these civilizations was the same. Conquest, confiscation, the erection of the state, then the sequences which we have traced in the course of our own civilization, then the shock of some eruption which the social structure was too far weakened to resist, and from which it was left too disorganized to recover, and then the end. Our pride resents the thought that the great highways of New England will one day lie deep under layers of encroaching vegetation, as the more substantial Roman roads of old England have lain for generations, and that only a group of heavily overgrown hillocks will be left to attract the archaeologist's eye to the hidden debris of our collapsed skyscrapers. Yet it is to just this, we know, that our civilization will come, and we know it because we know there has never been, never is, and never will be any disorder in nature, because we know that things and actions are what they are, and the consequences of them will be what they will be. But there is no need to dwell lugubriously upon the probable circumstances of a future so far distant. What we and our more nearly immediate descendants shall see is a steady progress in collectivism running off into a military despotism of a severe type. Closer centralization, a steadily growing bureaucracy, state power and faith in state power increasing, social power and faith in social power diminishing, the state absorbing a continually larger proportion of the national income, production languishing, the state in consequence taking over one essential industry after another, managing them with ever-increasing corruption, inefficiency, and prodigality, and finally resorting to a system of forced labor. Then, at some point in this progress, a collision of state interests, at least as general as that which occurred in 1914, will result in an industrial and financial dislocation too severe for the asthenic social structure to bear, and from this the state will be left to the rusty death of machinery, and the casual anonymous forces of dissolution will be supreme. 3. But it may be quite properly asked, if we in common with the rest of the Western world are gone so far in statism as to make this outcome inevitable, what is the use of a book which merely shows that it is inevitable? By its own hypothesis, the book is useless. Upon every evidence it offers, no one's political opinions are likely to be changed by it, no one's practical attitude towards the state will be modified by it, and if they are, according to the book's own premises, what good could they do? Assuredly, I do not expect this book to change anyone's political opinions, for it is not meant to do that. One or two, perhaps, here and there, may be moved to look a little into the subject matter on their own account, and thus perhaps their opinions would undergo some slight loosening, or some constriction. But this is the very most that would happen. In general, too, I would be the first to acknowledge that no results of the kind which we agree to call practical could accrue to the credit of a book of this order, were it 100 times as cogent as this one. No results, that is, that would in the least retard the state's progress in self-aggrandizement, and thus modify the consequences of the state's course. There are 2 reasons, however, one general and one social, why the publication of such a book is admissible. The general reason is that when any department of thought a person has or thinks he has a view of the plain intelligible order of things, it is proper that he should record that view publicly, with no thought whatever of the practical consequences or lack of consequences likely to ensue upon his doing. He might indeed be thought bound to do this as a matter of abstract duty, not to crusade or propagandize for his view or seek to impose it upon anyone, far from that, not to concern himself at all with either its acceptance or its disallowance, but merely to record it. This, I say, might be thought his duty to a natural truth of things, but it is at all events his right, it is admissible. The special reason has to do with the fact that in every civilization, however generally prosaic, however addicted to the short-time point of view on human affairs, there are always certain alien spirits who, while outwardly conforming to the requirements of the civilization around them, still keep a disinterested regard for the plain intelligible law of things, irrespectable of any practical end. They have an intellectual curiosity, sometimes touched with emotion, concerning the august order of nature. They are impressed by the contemplation of it, and like to know as much about it as they can, even in circumstances where its operation is ever so manifestly unfavourable to their best hopes and wishes. For these, a work like this, however in the current sense impractical, is not quite useless, and those of them it reaches will be aware that for such as themselves, and such only, it was written. The End. A printed copy of this book can be purchased, or a PDF downloaded, from the Ludwig von Mises Institute's website at mises.org by searching for Our Enemy the State. Mr. Nock included many footnotes in the book, and these are only available in the printed editions.